We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This hour of Focus 580 will be continuing with the theme that we have set for the morning. We'll be talking again in this hour about water, something that grew out of a recent program that we did looking at water resources in this part of the state, where the water comes from, who's using it, how much is being used, and how to best plan for the future. And someone heard that conversation and said, well, that's good. We really need to talk more about water and how we use it, and suggested that we might talk with the guest that we have in this hour of Focus 580, Robert Glennon. He's the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy in the Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. And he has written a lot about water. He's the author of the book Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping and the Fate of America's Fresh Waters. He, in fact, was here on the campus of the University of Illinois a few years back, and we talked about that book. His new book is titled Unquenchable. The subtitle is America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. It's published by Island Press. And he makes the argument that when it comes to water, that Americans are really spoiled, that we have gotten used to turning on the tap and watching as high-quality water comes pouring out. And it's also very cheap. In fact, there is only one industrial nation where the people pay less for their water than we do, and that's Canada. He points out that we're paying less for our water than we pay for our cell phone service or cable TV. And while we may think of water as something that is inexhaustible, it is in fact a finite resource. And as population grows, demands grow, he says this is not a problem that we can engineer ourselves out of. We need, he says, a kind of a system that values water both as a commodity and as a fundamental human right. So he explores all of these issues in his book. We'll talk about that. Questions are welcome. All that we ask is people who are calling in, try to keep their questions, comments brief. That way we can keep moving along. But anybody is welcome to join the conversation. 333-9455 and toll-free. 800-222-9455. At any point here, certainly you are welcome to call. Professor Glennon, hello.
Good morning, David.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me on your show. It's nice to be back with you.
We appreciate it. Well, we think this is an important issue, and it's good to have the opportunity to talk about it from time to time. And certainly it seems to me that while I'm sure that what you say is true, that we take water for granted, that it seems at least that it is something that people are starting to talk about more. And certainly in parts of the country where in the past they hadn't really thought much about water at all, say in the Midwest, for example, or in the Southeast, certainly in recent years, they have started to think about the way that they use water and asking this question, well, is the way we use it sustainable?
I think you're right. It's a major change in the way people think about water. Until fairly recently, no one or very few people except in the business thought about it at all. And if you just look in the Midwest and you see the effort to bring about a Great Lakes Compact over the last 10 years, that was a successful effort of the Great Lakes states to come together and to figure out what should be done about the Great Lakes. There's a lot of concern in Illinois now about some pollution problems up north from where you are, down in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's getting people's attention. And elsewhere as well, But David, I have to say, our attention span is about that of a gerbil. We don't really stay with the issue. And an example I would give you for that is Atlanta. Metro Atlanta, home to 4.5 million people, came within 90 days a year and a half ago of literally running out of water, of having its principal reservoir, Lake Lanier, go dry. The city responded with some rather modest restrictions on use, no filling of swimming pools, watering of lawns, washing of cars, that sort of thing. Well, beyond that, what did they do? Well, the governor decided that he would hold a prayer vigil. And so he gathered on the Capitol steps with some ministers and people of faith, and they prayed for rain. But the governor was not a guy to take chances, so he didn't schedule the prayer vigil until weather forecasters predicted it was going to rain. Well, what else did they do? Well, what else they didn't do is more sort of a Sherlock Holmes, the dog didn't bark line. What they didn't do was to prohibit new wells from being drilled into the aquifer. And in the midst of this incredible drought, anyone who wanted was free to drill a new well and did not even need a permit until the use exceeded 100,000 gallons of water per day. Then you'd need a permit, and the permits were easy to come to. Yeah. And once rainstorms eased the drought, the restrictions were relaxed. So what you see in Georgia is a city that was looking over the abyss, but the moment a couple of rainstorms came along, apathy returned.
Yeah. And you know, you in the book cite some examples of profligate use. I think that you need look no farther than this this project that you talked about at the Stone Mountain Amusement Park in Georgia, where they decided they were going to set up a snowmaking operation.
A snowmaking operation outdoors in the midst of the worst drought in recent memory. On a day, David, when the temperature reached 81 degrees, you just have to scratch your head and say to yourself, what were these people thinking or not thinking? Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about how it is demand for water has grown, and particularly how it seems that demand for water is growing in those places where the water is already scarcest?
Yeah, sure. The big driver, of course, is population growth. We went over 300 million in the U.S. just a couple of years ago, but the Census Bureau predicts that by mid-century, 2050, we will hit 420 million people. That's another person every 11 seconds for 40 years. Well, where's the water going to come from? That's a big driver of it. There's other drivers. There are some pretty indulgent uses of water in Phoenix, Arizona. Affluent people like to have power showers with multiple heads. All of the heads could take the paint off walls. There are theme parks like the Stone Mountain one you mentioned. There's bottled water as a new demand. There's energy consumption and energy production as a new demand. And that affects you folks right there in Illinois when you turn to ethanol production, the corn that's needed for that. So there's, you know, quite a few different demands. And the problem is that the crisis in the U.S. is not uniform. There are still some states that have good water supplies. Michigan would be one. But as your question implies, people are moving from where the water is to where the water isn't, or at least where there isn't enough. On the top of the hour, NPR News indicated that Florida has had a dip in population. But I don't think anyone thinks that's going to last very long the moment the economy comes back. And when you look where else people are moving to, it's states like Georgia and North Carolina and the Southeast, Texas down that way, and then the western states. And all of those states are really scrambling to find water to support this growth.
Yeah. You use an image, and I liked it so much that I used it myself to try to set up the first hour where we're talking about water, groundwater regulation here in the state. And that's the big glass and the straws, where you say that, you know, think of the water supply as a gigantic soda glass, and people are coming along and they're putting in straws to suck out the water. And the problem is most places in this country, there is little or no regulation on how many straws you can put in the glass, and we're just keep filling up the glass just as fast as we can, putting in new straws.
New straws, but no, we can't fill the glass with more water.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely. I love that metaphor. I use it again and again and again because it captures the problem of water. Now, it does beg the question. Well, wait a minute. There's this thing called the hydrologic cycle, and we know from elementary school that we can't make water nor destroy water. So, what's the problem? Why isn't there still plenty of water out there? And the answer to that is that our uses of water preclude the reuse of water for decades or even centuries. For example, every time a toilet handle goes down in Los Angeles, as much as 6 gallons of water ends up in the Pacific Ocean. And that water is not available until the hydrologic cycle completes itself once again, which could take an incredibly long time. In other parts of the country, we're damaging the resources by overpumping, which produces saltwater intrusion. It causes subsidence, land fissures to open up, all of which compromises the supply. And then when you add in chemical contamination, what you have is a lot of water that we can no longer use because it's contaminated. So for all practical purposes, we really need to understand that water is finite, not infinite. It's not like air.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Robert Glennon. He is professor at the University of Arizona. He is the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy at the Rogers College of Law at University of Arizona, and has written a lot about water. His new book is titled Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. It's published by Island Press. Questions here on the program certainly are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I suppose that this gets us right to the question of what to do. First of all, in terms of the way that we use energy. Well, it's sort of the same thing. We're talking about using energy. I'm thinking about conservation. When we use water, how much difference would it make if, for example, everybody went out and they got a low-flow shower head, or they got a new toilet that uses the smallest amount of water possible, that in all the various ways that we use water, we were as efficient and as stingy as we possibly could be?
It would make a great deal of difference for municipal demand, and some places are beginning to move down that path. I tell a wonderful, I think very funny but poignant story of Santa Fe, New Mexico, that basically said to a developer, okay, if you want to build a new house, you have to retrofit 8 existing homes with low-flow fixtures. But pretty soon there was a veritable cottage industry of plumbers walking around door to door offering to swap out people's toilets. And it worked. It was great. So conservation by us as individuals is an important part of it. But it's not a magic bullet. It's not a simple solution. For one thing, that's because municipal use in the country is only between 70 and 10% of total water use. We really need to be thinking about agricultural water use to get the national picture, because farmers use about 80% of the nation's water. So we need to figure out ways to encourage farmers to be more efficient. And that's in some places, a very, very expensive proposition, because irrigation systems are costly. So what I argue for in Unquenchable is to make development pay its own way, just as Santa Fe did. If you want to put in a new housing subdivision, that's fine. I'm not saying there's no growth. But what I am saying is you need to offset your demand by, going back to our milkshake glass, by taking someone else's straw out of the glass.
And
wonderful examples around the United States where that's happening. And what that does then is it empowers farmers. It gives them the necessary resources to modernize their irrigation systems.
So this, it seems this is a very important idea, that what you're saying is that it's simply by, again, going back to the glass with the straws, we cannot continue just to put more straws in the glass, that if you want to come along and put your straw in, what you're going to have to do is figure out some way to get somebody else's straw drawn out, which seems... That seems difficult. Is it possible just to do that but with greater efficiencies, or are there some cases where simply some uses are just going to have to be eliminated?
Well, it depends on the particular localized facts. I just finished a National Research Foundation study with two economists of water transfers in the American West. And between 1985 and 2005, there were about 3,200 of these transfers, and most of them involved agricultural water moving out of farming into municipal, industrial, or quite a bit into environmental uses. The water involved was a lot of water, David, about twice the annual flow of the Colorado River. That's about 30 million acre-feet of water. And despite all of this water moving out of agriculture, what we found was that aggregate farm income, held constant for inflation, did not go down. Well, how can that be? Well, because farmers are savvy business people. And when faced with an opportunity to make some money because the developers need to offset their demand, they seize that opportunity and then use the money for on-farm improvements. They change the irrigation system. In some cases, they may fallow lands, but, of course, the lands they fallow are the ones that were unproductive. You know, the one with the clay soil where the bushels per acre was pretty low, so they're not losing much along those lines. And another thing that farmers are doing is they're altering their crop mix. I tell what I think is just a delightful story about a Yuma, Arizona farmer who had been growing iceberg lettuce, and now he began to grow these baby lettuces. They're popular all over the country. They're triple-washed lettuces. They're in bags and plastic boxes. And believe me, they sell for a heck of a lot more money than the old head of iceberg does. And it takes less labor to harvest the fields. They've created this ingenious system, which is basically a gigantic electric razor that goes down the rows, shaves the lettuces off. The lettuce goes up a conveyor belt, falls into boxes, gets moved by another conveyor belt to the truck next door, and then driven to the market. So there's lots of ways that farmers are adjusting to using less water without compromising their incomes. Mm.
I think just in terms of other industrial uses, I think you've said that, in fact, a lot of, non-agricultural industrial uses of water have actually in recent years done a pretty good job of being efficient in the way that they use water.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there's a sort of a startling statistic. If you look over 20 or 25 years, you see that industrial use and power plant use for electric generation has actually slightly dipped. Now, that's a little misleading because the USGS hasn't come out with more recent figures. They're somewhat dated. They go back to 2000, so we're already in 2009. But still, that's interesting. And the driver behind that, David, was the Clean Water Act. And what you found was that power plants, whether nuclear, coal-fired, or other, found it more expensive to release the water than they did to comply with the act by using it more efficiently. In another example I give in the book, the Intel Corporation, semiconductor producers, reduced their water use by 75%. And the reason for that was largely the mandate of the Clean Water Act. They were no longer free to simply dump their waste stream with these heavy chemicals that are needed for the semiconductor production into our waters. But that we shouldn't get carried away with that little dip because it confuses a general statistic with localized problems. And the statistic or the sort of the quip I would give there is it's the same as having Bill Gates walk into your neighborhood bar. The moment he does that, the average patron is a millionaire. But other than Gates, everyone in the bar is still doing a shot and a beer, you know, so they don't feel like millionaires, and they're not. So the same thing nationwide. Overall use has, for industrial and electric production, has slightly dipped, but localized, it's a very different story.
Yeah. Let's talk with someone here in Urbana, where we are, who has a question, comment, line two. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I agree with all that your guest has said, and I applaud all the efforts that have been made to make water usage for agricultural and industrial purposes more efficient. How far have you gotten in your efforts to educate officials and elected politicians on the necessity of this when you have the old inertia problem where they don't want to move from where they are, and don't want to really face an issue that might end up with them getting voted out of office?
Well, you make a good point, a couple of good points about the survivability of local officials. I mean, we get the government that we deserve, and when you start to talk about controversial issues, and we can see from the recent healthcare debate, getting out in front is a very iffy business for politicians, particularly when we start to talk about price increases for water, which is one of the things I advocate for. Whenever I start to talk about that around elected officials, they sort of move their chairs away from me and turn the other way. So it's a major problem, but it's not a problem that we can ignore. It won't go away. The point I'd make to you, sir, is one of the problems that I see is the sort of double standard of local officials saying out of one corner of their mouths, residents, you need to save water. And then out of the other corner of the mouths, they vote yes on every rezoning request for every new subdivision.
American voters
and residents are not stupid. They get that that's ridiculous. You can't ask people to conserve and then just use it for mindless sprawl.
Well, you're pretty close to what I guess from reporting on Florida's aquifers had to say some time back on this station. So thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We're about midway through this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Robert Glennon. He teaches law at the University of Arizona and is the author of the new book, Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. Island Press is the publisher. One really interesting area of water use that you talk about has to do with how it is we use water in our homes, what we use it for, and how we treat it. We spend a lot of resources into putting drinking quality water in people's homes, so they turn on the tap and they can get that. However, only a small percentage of that water is actually used for drinking and cooking. We use it for a lot of other things as well, to flush our toilets, to water our lawns, where maybe you would say, well, we really don't need drinking quality water to do that. And yet we put an awful lot of money into, you know, and taking the water that goes down the toilet and goes down the drain, cleaning it up so we can turn it right around and give it back to people. A lot of that water that we're giving back to them, again, you know, only a little bit of that really needs to be drinking quality water. We could use the other water in different ways. I guess the problem is we would have to have two separate systems to handle that water, and that would mean an enormous investment in new infrastructure.
You state the problem well, David. And yes, that is one of the points in my book. One of the main themes is to examine what we do with human waste. A century ago, Teddy Roosevelt said that a civilized society should be able to figure out something to do with its sewage other than put it in its drinking water. But in 2009, that's what we do all over the United States, is we take potable water, we use only 10% of it in our homes for cooking and bathing, and the rest of it we use for non-potable purposes. One-third of all the water used inside the home goes for the toilet. That's 7 billion gallons of water a day. And we waste water that way. We waste money. It takes more than $50 billion a year to treat that water. We waste energy. I hope we'll get a chance to talk about the water-energy connection. Mm-hmm. And we compromise human health because it's not well understood that water that comes out of the treatment plants, conventional treatment plants, does not remove what the EPA is calling, quote, emerging contaminants, unquote. And these are things that are endocrine disruptors, personal care medicines, everything from antibiotics to birth control pills to erectile dysfunction medicines to hormone supplements, all, you know, gifts of the modern pharmacy era. And yet what we do is we ingest those pills, but our body only absorbs some of the pill, and the rest of it we excrete and then flush away to the treatment plant. But the treatment plants don't remove these chemicals. And the scientists are finding that the fish and the frogs downstream are looking mighty strange, intersex fish and deformed frogs. Now, we don't know what the consequence of this is for human health. And the issue is ingesting very, very microscopic amounts of a veritable cocktail of different drugs has what consequence for us. We don't know the answer to that. But it sure doesn't sound very good.
Yeah.
So what I'm arguing for is, look, at our wastewater and sewer water systems are in a horrible state of disrepair. We need to do something about that. Now is the time to fix it, but not to simply rebuild the old system again. So I call for a national commission to examine waterless ways to deal with human health. we're already seeing some of this. I mean, in the West here, and here at the University of Arizona, toilets are waterless. Lots of football and other athletic stadiums have waterless toilets. There are composting toilets. We need to really support the disposal of human waste without the use of water.
And just to, you were talking about your suggestion is to have a kind of a commission to look at our water infrastructure. And one of the things that certainly we do know is that the system that we have is old, it's in bad shape, and a tremendous amount of water is lost simply through leakage.
Absolutely. There's leaks all, I think Philadelphia suffers like 800 water leaks a year. I mean, there are some pipes in the United States, David, are 200 years old. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's back to Tom Jefferson's days. You know, it's a shambles. So we need to take care of our water and sewer water systems. But 800 cities in the U.S. have combined sewer and storm water, which means that every time it rains, you've got all of this water that you're now mixing with human waste, and you have to send the whole thing to the treatment plant to get rid of the human waste. Well, that was a pretty silly thing to do.
Well, do you? I mean, we talked about a couple of things here as far as waste, human waste disposal is concerned. One would be to have a different kind of toilet, one that doesn't use water to flush. I suppose the other would be if you're going to have flush toilets, figure out some way to use non-potable water to do the flushing. And of course, then there's still the question of what you do after that. Does one or the other of those make more sense? I mean, either a different toilet or use gray water to flush it.
I think both are things that we can explore. You can use gray water. You can use what's called reclaimed water. Gray water typically means water from the washing machine, mm-hmm. not from your toilet or your sink. But you can use washing machine water for that. In many parts of the West now, we're starting to use water from the treatment plant for non-potable purposes, for watering golf courses, for highway medians, for light industrial applications, for cemeteries, things like this. So there's a lot of uses we can make of water that's not of potable quality. But as you implied, David, it is expensive. It does require a dual system of pipes. So it's easier to do this for new construction than it is to retrofit an existing construction, an existing house. If you just think about your washing machine, it's probably somewhere in the inside of the house, and how are you going to get that washing machine water outside? Yeah. There's some neat people in the Bay Area, though, who are really pioneering about this. They call themselves the Gray Water Gorillas, a group of women in Oakland. And I described, in Unquenchable, I described their work.
One of the people I expect probably have heard the story of how they recycled urine on the space station. And while that might not seem particularly appealing notion, there certainly are places where water is scarce enough or there's enough pressure on the resource that they're starting to say, you know, rather than, say, as we do in coastal areas, just essentially we treat it to some level and then we flush it into the ocean or other places where it ends up getting into the natural water, that in fact that's a terrible waste. What we're doing is throwing away usable water, that if we could take that and clean it up, then we could give it back to people and they could drink it again. Now the question is, I suppose, would they, if they knew that's what it was, how long would it take to get people around to the notion that that's okay?
Well, and you're putting your finger on it. It's what I call the yuck factor. what a smart aleck reporter for the San Diego Tribune called the toilet to tap proposal. Mm-hmm. Well, that was dead on arrival. But if you think about it there in Illinois and you think about the Mississippi River, I mean, that's effectively what's going on is you get communities along the Mississippi treating their water, dumping it in the river, it goes downstream. Next community diverts it, does the same thing, goes downstream. Now, the space program, that's a new program, the completely recycled urine. The science is out there. Down here on Earth in California, the Orange County Water District embarked on such a kind of program on a small scale last year. It's about a $480 million project. They didn't just spring it on the public unawares. They held more than a, they held God only knows how many meetings over the course of a year to bring the public along, to educate them about what they were doing. And they use very sophisticated treatment processes, not the conventional ones I was referring to before, but they use reverse osmosis and other methods to really alter treat it. And then they use it by putting it into their reservoir system. So eventually people will be delivered to their homes, but not before this very intense treatment process.
Yeah. When people think of industrial users of water, I'm sure that they first thing they think of is agriculture. And that's actually, when we talk about this kind of use, that's actually a category all to itself. Industrial users, though, are very significant. And this gets to this connection between water and energy. Not only does it take water to produce energy, but it's very important in energy production and in a lot of other kinds of industrial high-tech industrial uses as well.
Absolutely, and quite surprising. The company Google comes to mind, and I tell this story in Unquenchable as well. I was surprised, and I think probably most of your listeners would be surprised to think of Google as a heavy water user.
Mm-hmm.
What we know Google for is the search engine. It's the incredible formula that they've used to systematize searches. But what actually runs those searches are what the industry calls server farms. These things bear no resemblance to old McDonald's farm. They are giant concrete windowless buildings housing thousands or even tens of thousands of computers. Well, if you imagine that many computers all hooked up, you're generating a lot of heat. Think 10,000 toaster ovens, and you begin to get the idea. So Google needs to get rid of this heat if it's not going to have the computers crash and burn. So it air conditions the building using water, because water is this incredible coolant. We know that from our automobile engines. And so they need a lot of water in order to run their server farms. In fact, the Internet is a huge consumer of energy in the country. Already, it uses about 1.5% of the entire country's electrical supply, and that's expected to double in the next 18 months. Now, back to the water-energy connection. It takes a lot of water to produce energy, and conversely, it takes a lot of energy to pump, move, treat, cleanse, and deliver water. So there's a very intimate connection between the two.
Questions are certainly welcome here. We're moving into about our last 20 minutes. Again, our guest is Robert Glennon. He's a professor of law at University of Arizona. He's author of the book Water Follies, Groundwater Pumping and the Fate of America's Fresh Waters. We talked about that book here on this program a couple of years ago. And this morning we are talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his new book. The title is Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It, published by the Island Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I am sure that when you talk about the problem of water shortages, there is someone who will point out that most of the surface of the earth is covered with water. The problem is that it's salt water. Just how practical, or would it ever be practical, to consider that a water source?
It's practical right now. And it's practical in places such as Saudi Arabia that have lots of oil. It's practical right now in places like cruise ships and on islands where there is literally no choice. There is the technology out there to take the salt out of water and to render salt water potable. But it's many times more expensive than traditional water sources. And it uses itself scads of energy, because the membranes required are very high-tech, very expensive, very delicate, and prone to fouling. So when you use a lot of pressure to push water through these membranes, you get frequent tearing of the membranes, requiring their replacement. The final problem with desal is that you have to figure out, after you finish this process, what to do with the brine flow, the str- stream, the concentrated stream that you produced, because the salt doesn't go away. What you've done is you've now concentrated the salt in a smaller quantity of water. You've removed the salt from some water, but you've put that salt in the remaining water. And that's not so easy to do, to get rid of that brine stream without creating some serious environmental problems. So desal is certainly possible. It's best to be thought about in terms of high-value uses or places that have more oil than they know what to do with. Don't expect to see farmers using desal water to grow alfalfa anytime or residents to water lawns. But if you're a coastal city or if you're an inland city with some brackish water, it's part of a portfolio that some cities are moving toward.
Yeah. Maybe one reason that people have been so careless in their water use is that for a lot of people, a lot of places, water has actually been very cheap. I was really impressed with that statistic, and I mentioned at the beginning that of all industrial countries, there's only the Canadians pay less for their water than we do. And you, in fact, you make this further point that I think is really interesting, that in fact, when we pay our water bills, what we're paying the water company for is all of the infrastructure and everything that's involved in getting the water to us, that in fact, we're not paying anything for the water at all, itself.
And that's very surprising. I mean, we pay less for water than we do for cell phone service or cable television. It's remarkably cheap. And when you examine what you're paying for, it's exactly as you describe it, David. It's for the costs of service. There is still no commodity charge for water. Even worse, in some cities in the United States, there's no charge even for the cost of service. An example there would be some cities in California, including Fresno. You can, as a resident of Fresno, simply use as much water as you want. Well, that produces a lot of water guzzlers. The average consumption per person in Fresno is about 300 gallons per person per day. Now, if you go right next door to the town of Clovis has water meters, and their per capita consumption is 200 gallons. So it's 50% more in Fresno than in Clovis because there's no meters.
Yeah. You know, I know that there have been places at various times when there weren't. I think that there was a time in the Chicago area because they were drawing on Lake Michigan when there was no metering. I think that that's changed. It just surprises me that in California, where they have serious water issues, that there would be any place where there was no metering.
Well, it does seem that way, but California has not. Many parts of California have not gotten their hands around the value of water. Sacramento not only doesn't have any meters, but last year in the middle of the drought, when a couple decided they would just not water their front lawn, the company threatened to fine them $750 for failing to maintain their front lawn. And here they are trying to chip in, Governor Schwarzenegger saying we all have to take this crisis seriously, and Sacramento is fining people for not watering their lawns. Hmm. The mayor of San Diego a few months ago announced a new era of water history. Well, why was the mayor so proud? Because regulations would prohibit San Diego residents from watering their lawns more than three times a week. Now, I think that's akin to rearranging the deck chairs. This is not a serious effort to deal with water as an important resource. What San Diego and Los Angeles need to do is to reflect on the reality that they are deserts. You would be surprised, I think, David, to know that they get only one inch of rain a year more than we do in Tucson, Arizona.
Yeah.
It's a desert, but they import more water than any place else on Earth. Well, Californians' love affair with lawns needs to be reexamined. Back to the price.
Mm-hmm.
Some California cities, in fact, one-third of all American cities, have declining block rates, which is the more water you use, the less you pay for each additional unit of water. Well, that's madness. It needs to be. The incentives need to be just the other way around. The more water you use, the more you should pay for that water so as to encourage conservation. Mm-hmm. Now, some people will say, well, but what about people of modest means, poor people? Well, I think what we need to do there is to recognize that in the United States, people have a human right to water. If we in the richest country in the history of the world can't make that commitment to our people, then we are a sorry lot. So let's just recognize that. It turns out it's not a lot of water. It's about 12 to 15 gallons per person per day. But let's just deliver that. And then after that, we need sensible pricing policies, which will increase as our use increases. And we need to make it seasonally adjusted so that when you use more water in the summertime, which people do, it's for outdoor landscaping and for swimming pools and other discretionary uses. I'm not saying ban those uses. I'm not saying the heavy hand of government regulation. What I'm saying is let's use something we haven't even tried in the United States, which is price signals and market forces to encourage conservation and to reallocate water from low value to higher value uses.
Let's talk with somebody else here in Bloomington, Illinois, line number 4 on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. Thanks for a great show. I have several questions, but I was going to install one of these reverse osmosis units in my kitchen for the water. Is that going to purify it enough?
Oh, reverse osmosis is a very high-tech system. Yes, I think it will. I wouldn't know whether you need to install a reverse osmosis system. In most communities in the United States, the water that's already delivered is very high-quality water.
I thought you said the treatment units aren't treating the water properly.
Well, the treatment is a problem. The emerging contaminants I mentioned, these endocrine disruptors. And the scary part is that many cities are not testing for them because EPA hasn't yet figured out what the minimum threshold would be or what you're supposed to do if you find a residue of antibiotics in the water supply. What is it that we do? We don't have minimum or maximum numbers on when that's when that needs further treatment.
Oh, that's why I was thinking of installing one of these.
Mm-hmm. I mean, people are doing that. Other people are turning to bottled water.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, that's no solution.
No.
There's a wonderful book called Bottle Mania by Elizabeth Royt.
Right.
And she concludes that bottled water, with very rare exceptions, is no safer than tap water. In fact,
unless
it's just the other way around.
Unless you buy bottled water that says it's purified by reverse osmosis.
Then you'd get that additional benefit, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you think that as humans, are we in the final analysis going to stay on top of this thing?
Oh, I think we are. I'm very optimistic. I mean, in Unquenchable, what I'm trying to do is to raise a flag and to say that the country is facing a crisis. But a crisis is a time of opportunity. In the book, I have a menu of options that can involve individuals, local government, state government, federal government. There's lots of things we can do. And what we need is the political will and the moral courage to act. Because if we don't act, then the crisis can become a catastrophe. And then we can't do that. I mean, one of the main themes in Unquenchable is that water lubricates the American economy just as oil does. And if we want a healthy economy, we need to take care of this precious resource.
What can we as individuals do just in our own little bailiwick?
I've got one great example, and in the last chapter I go into more detail about this. There's a water conservation organization here in Tucson that I cite the website for them, Water CASA, C-A-S-A, is their acronym. You could go on the web and get their stuff. But this one example, your kitchen food disposal. Water CASA has concluded that even with an aerator on your faucet, if you run your faucet 2 minutes a day to use your food disposal, over the course of a month, you will use 150 gallons of water. Now that's something you can easily just take the food scraps and put them in the garbage or put them in a compost pile. You don't need 150 gallons of water to get rid of food scraps.
Mm, yeah,
That's a small example that I think very few people are aware of.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Let's go on to another caller here. This is Chicago, line number one. Hello.
Thank you. Could you comment on the horizon? How does the matter of desalination of water appear to be one condition we're going to have to utilize?
I'm not quite sure I understand the question. How the
desalination of water is being considered as turning the water to our use rather than just letting the fishes in.
Sure. I'm going to be quick on this one because I addressed this a little earlier in the show. Desal is possible. The limitations on desal are, first, that it's very expensive. Second, that it uses tons of energy. And third, that you need to figure out something to do with the concentrated salts that end up in the brine stream after you've completed the desalination process. That said, there are places around the United States, from Florida to California, that are moving forward with desalination, and there's a lot of interest in it. I was in Zurich, Switzerland earlier this year at an international conference giving a talk, and there are all kinds of really cutting-edge scientific advancements being made, including by a fellow right there at the University of Illinois. I'm sorry to say I don't have his name off the top of my head, doing very interesting stuff on treating water. The problem is this. The scientific community and the creators and inventors have devised all kinds of nifty ways to save water. But if the water remains as cheap as it is, no one's going to use these inventions or techniques to save water. We need to encourage conservation in part by having a price structure that's sensibly...
I had heard that some scientific breakthrough, I believe it's Sir Charles Schultz in England, has an energy sun-powered way of microwaving the sun's energy to the earth and then utilizing that energy as a cheap, very inexpensive way for desalination as another use. So the energy problem may be solved in the short term, hopefully. But another question was regarding flooding and so forth, where the water just essentially is run off into streams and whatever. Some have proposed huge tunnels to sequester the flooded water into the aquifers. As a matter of replenishing the aquifers to some degree whenever there's flooding. So I thought I'd mention that as one thing that was mentioned. Thank you
sure.
very much.
Well, let me take the first one, which is your comment on solar energy. Solar energy is very hot these days. The Obama administration's pushing it, and there are lots of startup companies moving forward, some better established companies. But solar energy itself can use a lot of water. Now, there are two types of solar. There are the photovoltaic cells that you probably see on your neighbor's roof that she uses to heat hot water. But that's not commercially viable at utility scale. The kind of solar that's viable at utility scale is something called concentrating solar thermal. And that uses the sun's heat to heat a medium to boil water to create steam. The steam turns a turbine. But if you think about it, that's just an old-fashioned power plant, but it uses the sun at the first step. After step one, it's a power plant, and power plants use a lot of water. Now, right now, the Bureau of Land Management has a request for more than 150 permits for power plants smack dab in the middle of the Mojave Desert. And the question I've asked, and I asked it in a Washington Post piece that I wrote, is where is the water going to come from for all of these solar plants? Now let's turn to your flooding issue. There's some great folks out there doing what's called harvesting of water. It can be something that you do as an individual homeowner. You just take water that runs off your roof into your downspout, and then rather than getting it away from your property, you put it in a basin and use it to water your plants. There's lots of different ways of harvesting water. And here in Tucson, we're doing some of that. We're trying to encourage exactly what you said, sir, which is to recharge the aquifer by using storm waters. There is that possibility. Now, at some level, though, you have to realize that rivers need flood flows to be healthy. You can't just keep taking all the floodwaters away, because floods, all the scientists who study this stuff, people who study fluvial geomorphology, will tell you that you need high flows in order to have a healthy stream, because the high flows remove sediment that would otherwise clog the stream and impede the flows of waters.
Yeah, I suppose that it's worth making the point that recharge of aquifers, it happens, but it takes a long time. And if you're pumping it out just as fast as you can, it's even if you capture storm runoff, that's not going to recharge to the – it's not going to equal the amount of water that you're taking out.
It depends, of course, on the individual localized facts, but that's absolutely true, David, as a general proposition around the country. I mean, we're pumping water that was deposited in some instances back when the dinosaurs were around, and yet the water tables are plummeting in many parts of the United States in mere decades.
Yeah. We are going to have to stop. My apologies. We have a couple of callers we can't take, but certainly folks who are interested in reading more on this issue can look for the book that we have talked about. There's much more in here about water use across the country, who uses it, how much we're using it, and what we should do about that. The title of the book is Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. It's published by the Island Press by our guest, Robert Glennon. He is the Morris K. Udall Professor of Law and Public Policy in the Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. And Professor Glennon, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure to be with you, David. Thanks for having me on the show.